Today's guest is Teja Kote, who's the CEO of Airbase. Prior to that, he was the CEO and co-founder of a company called Automattic, which sold to SiriusXM for more than $100 million. On today's episode, we cover his upbringing and why he decided to dive into entrepreneurship. More importantly, we talk about how he separates his business identity from the identity of his startup, as well as how they acquired their first set of customers. And talking about acquiring customers, it is 2022. And if you're not tapping into the relationships in the network of your advisors, your executives, your coworkers, your colleagues, and your customer advisory board, you're doing it wrong. That's why you need to reach out to CoSell and learn how they can operationalize and help you start referral selling. You can learn more at CoSell.io.
Teja Kote, founder CEO of Airbase. And, I was born in India, grew up there, and moved to the US about 11 years ago at this point. And, this is my second company. Before this, I built and sold another one called Automattic, which was a connected car platform. When I was building that business, learned a lot about the problem I'm solving now with Airbase. And what we do is, we help bring all of the non-payroll dollars that a business spends into a single platform. So we call that category spend management. It has been a category in the enterprise segment, but it's emerging as a new category in the SMB and mid-market segments. We tend to focus more on mid-market companies, say 100 plus employees, all the way up to about 5,000 employees. If you think about how they spend money, they typically have a corporate card system, a bill payments or AP platform, like a bill.com or an expense reimbursement system, like an Expensify, and on and on and on, right? So they have like typically half a dozen different systems involved in just the simple process of how do you spend money as a business. And it can get, you know, very painful as a business scales for the finance and accounting teams, for employees, for budget owners, all the different personas in the business. And our approach is very simply to say, hey, instead of having that many different systems and silos, it is a much better experience if you bring it all together into one single consistent experience and platform. And that's what we do, right?
Love it. We'll get to the business side in a second, but we want to also get to know Teja, the person, in a second. So from your background, if I'm not mistaken, you moved to Berkeley in 2009, came here for your master's. And what I found fascinating is you jumped into entrepreneurship like right away in tandem. So I got to ask, where does that come from? Did you have like a chip on the shoulder? Or is that like, I'm just curious, like what motivated you right away to do two things at once?
Yeah, no, it was, part of the reason I came to the US was because I had a goal of doing something of my own at some point. I'm an engineer by training. I studied electrical engineering. And as I entered the professional workforce, my first job was at a large services company in India called Infosys, that some folks might have heard of. But what I learned as I joined that company as my first job pretty quickly was that one, big companies weren't really for me. While there was a lot I learned about myself for the first time, and I asked those questions of what do I want to do for the rest of my life in 30, 40 years of my professional career. And long story short, I landed at this place of, being an entrepreneur and creating something of my own would be fun and enjoyable and challenging. And so that's what I set out to do. I started off by working at a startup in India. And along that journey, I realized that there was so much for me to learn, especially if I wanted to create technology products, right? And as an engineer, the world was black or white, but I started to realize that, hey, all the interesting stuff happens, in the gray area in between. And there is a lot more to building shipping products and building teams and managing folks and all that kind of stuff. And I also felt geographically, it was important for me to be in Silicon Valley. This was back in 2008, 2009. Of course, the startup ecosystem is very different in India now, a lot more vibrant, which is amazing to see, but that wasn't the case back then, right? And so part of the reason I ended up coming to the US was I wanted to be here in the Bay Area, where obviously the ecosystem was already very mature and strong. And I thought could support my ambition of being an entrepreneur in a better way. And also to build the skills. I came here to get a master's. I studied human-computer interaction, user experience design. It didn't make me a good designer, but at least I think I learned enough to be able to identify good designers and work with good designers and build good products and things like that. So that's how I ended up here. And the fact that I ended up starting my previous company fairly quickly, right after I finished my master's. Actually, even during my master's, I was filtering every experience through, hey, is this a startup idea? And is this something I could do? But I was pretty clear that given how long some these journeys take, I didn't want to work on something just because I wanted to be a founder or start a company. I wanted to be passionate about the problem and be willing to put up with the ups and the downs that are inevitable over multiple years. Luckily I found that, right? As soon as I graduated in 2011, I was already working actually on the startup in some form, because it was research that my co-founder and I were doing in grad school. And we ultimately took a piece of it and said, okay, we could commercialize this and make it into a business and all of that. And so that's how it ended up working out.
What are some things that you think with experience, it just got easier for you?
Pretty much everything. Right? And we need a lot more time to dig into all of it. But at a high level, I actually asked myself that question when I started working on Airbase, is what did I learn? Right. And so I just had gone through that journey and we had sold the business and I was thinking of starting a new one. And the important question I asked myself was, did I learn anything? Like, what am I going to do differently this time around? And what lessons did I take away? And so I actually sat and wrote down a lot of those lessons, which even today I try to implement on a day-to-day basis. It could start from existential values like controlling your own destiny and how I hadn't done that really well when I was building Automattic, especially when you're a venture-funded company. How do you put yourself in a position where you are not always desperate to raise that next round of funding, or you're running out of money, or you have limited runway and the pressure is on you? Like, how do you really control your own destiny? What does it mean to control your own destiny? How do you think about your culture and values and being deliberate about shaping it, and all the lessons around hiring and team building and where you build teams, and how simple decisions like saying, I'm going to have an office in San Francisco, and that's what we did with Automattic, and how a simple decision like that can have huge second, third order effects on the business as you build it over the years, in terms of the difficulty of hiring and building very high quality teams, especially if you're not willing to compromise on the bar, retaining those people and competing in an incredibly kind of competitive environment out here in the Bay Area, and the cost of doing it, the challenges around capital efficiency when you sign up for something like that, and the path to profitability becoming even harder, on and on and on, right? And you have to raise more money, take more dilution. There are a lot of these things that you don't realize in the early days until you've kind of done some of those things and experienced it. What exactly are the downstream effects? And I guess the scars give you the ability to look around the corner a little bit more and anticipate what's going to happen at different stages of growth. And so those have been all the lessons among many that I've kind of brought to the journey at Airbase. That's on the kind of the business side of things, but also personally, like psychologically, like how do you as a founder not really intertwine your own sense of self-worth with the success of the company? And those are all things that I think I've gotten better at. How do you not burn out, which totally happened with Automattic and partly towards the end, the reason we sold. And I feel like I just didn't have the energy anymore to keep going, right? And so some of those things I'd like to think I'm smarter about and I'm doing better, but time will tell, right?
The last part of what you just said, I think I found fascinating, which is burnout, as well as making sure the identity of your startup is not the identity of the company, where you separate the two. What have you learned I think are tactical? If someone's listening and they're like on the other end of this podcast and they're like, I want to learn from your experience, what are some tactical things you've done over the years to get better at that?
Everything about the business was as though it was an extension of my personality, right? Every success, I felt it more. Every failure, I felt it more. And that's exhausting. That's part of what leads to the burnout. And I think, and this is not just me. I think a lot of people have done it a while and experience teaches you this. Life gives you more perspective, all those kinds of things. But with Airbase, what I've been able to do in a much better way is to separate out like Airbase, the company, and its success and its failures and challenges and all of that away from my own sense of self-worth. And the ability to separate those two have been incredibly important for me. And it also gives you the ability to really judge the company on its own merits, right? And because if it's not deeply personal, if you are able to step outside your own body and look at the company from afar and evaluate it in very objective terms, you know, as an investor would, as a potential employee who is considering joining your company would, and all of that kind of stuff, I think it's just much better discipline, and you are more mature for it, and you end up making better choices, and you are not kind of making decisions coming from a place of personal motivations and stuff like that, right? And so that has helped, right? Just separating out the two. It's mental discipline. It's easier said than done, and it is being willing to separate out the two, and being willing to understand your own psychology a little bit, and catching yourself when you're making certain decisions which might be driven because of your own motivations versus what's right or wrong for the company and those kinds of things. And I think I've just gotten a little bit more mature about it, and it partly has to do with experience, doing the job itself, and it partly maybe also has to do with just growing up in life, right? So I'm married now. I have kids, and that gives you a different kind of perspective about what's important in life.
I appreciate you for sharing. From the outside, one of the things I've admired is the focus and priority you put around transparency. Some folks share maybe 90%, some share 95%, but you've really prioritized sharing 100% of day-to-day equity stuff, like anything that might happen with the rest of your employees. Where does that come from, and why are you putting such a huge emphasis on that?
Look, when you're building a technology business, especially a venture funded technology business, and I think you've been through this too, your own journey, and it's so much about the people at the end of the day, right? And it is largely a whole group of people sitting behind a desk, bringing their creativity, ingenuity to work every day. And so much of success or failure depends on who you attract and who you retain, and that is a huge ultimately plays a role in the success or failure of the business. And so ultimately for me, transparency is, yes, it is the right thing to do, for sure. I think when people are putting their blood, sweat, and tears into the job to help them understand exactly why are they doing it, what is the impact of their role in the business, and what is the outcome of all the hard work that is happening across the different teams. And so I think it just plays a massive role in building the alignment across the business and making people feel like they're true owners of the business in a lot of ways, right? And that the work that they do actually has an impact. And so, even when I was always transparent about things, and even at Automatic, it was not like we hid anything or anything like that. But even then, I didn't understand just the degree to which it is okay to share a lot of the information about the company. And at Airbase, I think pretty much the only thing we don't share with our team and employees and everything is just maybe compensation data, right? And so that's probably a longer conversation about human psychology and why it's hard to kind of do that and be completely transparent about compensation data, stuff like that. But beyond that, everything is open, and everybody is open to raising their hands and asking questions about how we do specific things. And one of the things that I didn't do when I was building Automatic that I even go far as doing in Airbase is every time I've raised a round of funding, I walk the team through the term sheets and I tell them this is exactly what we've signed up for. And I think it also really builds trust in the team, right? Because what you want is to bring that sense of alignment, but also have the team understand that they can trust the team. They can really trust the leaders and the managers, and there is no secrecy here, and nobody is plotting to treat them badly, which unfortunately happens all too often, where not always are because you can make choices as leaders of a company, as management of a company, as the board of a company, you can always make choices that are not aligned with the best interests of the employees. And so this is an easy way, as far as I'm concerned, to say that, no, look, we're making the choices that ultimately are good for you. We're all in this together, and good or bad. And I think that engenders a huge amount of trust in the team, and a team that believes, a team that trusts, I believe, ultimately that accrues, especially across hundreds of people over long periods of time. And I am hopeful that the level of outcome that we would have otherwise been able to achieve, there's going to be a big delta when you are more transparent than not, right?
Yeah, 100%. It's the foundation you need that hopefully has a ripple effect for many years and hopefully many decades to come. I'm going to paraphrase before I ask this question. So to my knowledge, the way you got kind of started is you reached out to a couple of friends, started interviewing finance leaders. You saw that there was a gap here, created Airbase. Originally, I think if I'm not mistaken, you brought on some of the initial customers. I'm curious, at what point did you realize, hey, that there's something here, let's start hiring, whether it's a sales leader or a sales rep? Like, what were those anecdotes or data points that you're like, okay, let's make this repeatable, in other words? Give us a little bit of context for the early days.
Yeah, so I've tried to be quite disciplined about the iterative search for product market fit and being as capital efficient as possible as you work towards that. You're right, in the early days, I had a thesis about what the problem was and why it could be a fairly large business if you solved it well. But I spent a good 6 months speaking with dozens of CFOs, controllers, and the other folks, the primary stakeholders we serve today, learned a lot more about the problem and ultimately built conviction that look, there is a big opportunity here. But having conviction following conversations is one thing, but I also went as far as creating the solution in a low fidelity way and working with a designer and creating mock-ups of that, going back to those same people, showing them we talked about the problem, we agreed this is the problem. What if I solve it this way? Specific workflows, specific experiences. And that's a mistake I had made in the past of engineers build, right? And you don't realize that building is the most expensive thing you can do. Committing things to code is the most expensive thing you can do. And then there are sunk cost kind of issues with that where you don't want to then throw the thing away that you've spent a lot of time building. And it's a very expensive thing in general. So it's always better to learn as much as possible and sell in some ways ahead of actually having a product while setting the right expectations that this is where the maturity is right now. And so what I ended up doing was, hey, like, this is the mock-up and this is how it will look, the end experience. If I go build this, will you buy it? And does this actually solve your problem? And what isn't right about this? And so I actually had about 10 to 12 customers essentially say, yeah, you go build this, I will immediately adopt this. And I got to that point before I wrote the first line of code and then came back in. And so, for the longest time, as I was building a team around me, the early folks were all engineers. The early folks were all just building because as a founder, I was the salesperson. And I strongly recommend that every founder do that, especially if it's B2B software, where understanding the customer pain is such a key part of it. You can never outsource that, right? So you can never assume that, hey, I'm an engineer, I'm a product person, I'm going to go sit away in my room and I'm going to build something and somebody else will come and do the hard work of selling or convincing people to adopt it. It never works that way. So I think you have to be in front of customers. You have to have those conversations. You have to have the rejection. You have to hear what the real pain points are and truly understand that. And so I was the salesperson for the first, 18 months, almost 2 years of the life of the company. And I ended up selling those first 15, 20 deals and customers, essentially mid-market customers for us, right? So they were fairly large, hundreds of employees, stuff like that. And I had also defined what milestones are important for us, right? In terms of what does product market fit even mean, right? And what does it mean in terms of adoption? What does it mean in terms of for us, amount of money spent on the platform? What does it mean in terms of happiness of not just the finance and accounting teams, but also the rest of the employees? Because that was always an important aspect, like data points in terms of willingness to pay, on and on and on, right? So I had this definition of, look, I don't think we have product market fit until I have checked these boxes. And so I went about trying to check those boxes. And I really started scaling sales and marketing after I had checked those boxes and I felt, the evidence is there now. I have a good number of companies who have signed up for it, who are using it the right way, who are showing the right behavior while you're using it, who have shown a willingness to pay and have signed contracts and blah, blah, blah. Right? So there's a whole bunch of those things that have happened. At that point, we were ready to move past the founder-led sales phase of the company. And then I started hiring a sales team and which we have since obviously continued to scale.
Love it. Looking back, if I'm not mistaken, I believe you hired a sales leader before you hired a marketing leader. Would you agree that's the right path for a B2B company?
Look, maybe not. It really depends. It's circumstantial, right? And But in the early days, you definitely want somebody who, you know, is really good at demand generation, who isn't afraid of picking up the phone, hustling, cold calling, whatever the mode of that demand generation might be, right? And so having a marketing leader, you know, is good if you're confident that you're on the path to product market fit, right? But given that we focused on, you know, the mid-market customers, I ended up hiring a sales leader first because the outbound motion, experimenting with that, learning about that was also important for us. And, you know, would I have changed anything about that? I don't know. I think for us, it ultimately worked out, but it is not a bad question to ask if for me, given our sales motion, who should come first, right? Should it be marketing? Should it be sales? And, you know, in a lot of, because ultimately the goal is to make sure as you're building a sales team, you have enough pipeline, right? Because you don't want to hire a sales team and then continue to scale that sales team if you can't keep them fed, if you can't have enough pipeline for them to go close. And so how do you build that pipeline? What is your strategy to build that pipeline? So it really depends on the answer to that question. And so it's really circumstantial depending on the business, right?
This has been a phenomenal conversation. I can't thank you enough. We've gone actually way over the anticipated time. The one question we love to end with before we say our goodbyes is if you could go back to any time, in this case, let's just say maybe before you start on your first days at Berkeley, what advice would you give your younger self?
The validation of a belief that I had is one thing I would do. I would go tell myself, you know, yeah, you don't need to be the smartest person in the world, right? But hard work matters, right? Being prepared matters. I've always been a fan of Andy Grove's concept of earned luck, right? No matter how much success you have in life, luck always has a part to play in that. And I've had, you know, my share of luck along the way, but you have to be prepared. You have to kind of be ready to, you know, accept that luck and make the best of it when it comes. And there is definitely perseverance, persistence, and just a validation that, hey, that is the right belief, stay at it, right? So that's one. And the other one is really what I, you know, mentioned earlier about, you know, just the relationship between you and the business that you're building, and just being smarter about separating out the two and not connecting the success or failure of the company to your own personal self-worth and all of that. And those are lessons. Those are hard lessons that I've had to learn. And hopefully somebody has sat me down and helped me understand, you know, the importance of that. And I would have probably had fewer gray hair and probably more hair on my head if that had happened, right?
Yeah, well, we appreciate you for paying it forward for the next generation of founders. Thanks so much for coming on. For the listeners, we will put Tejo's contact information in the show notes. Please reach out. Thank him for coming on the show. And until next time, be safe, be well, and catch you on the next episode.
2022, and if you're not referral selling and tapping into the relationships you have, you're doing it all wrong. Sell more with your investors, your advisors, your customer advisory board, your executive team, and your coworkers. Learn how to do so at CoSell.